Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. For today's episode, we'll be reviewing more articles from Allergy Watch, a bi-monthly publication which provides research summaries to college members from the major journals of allergy and immunology, and by listening to this podcast, you can earn CME credit. So for information about that, head over to our website. It's education.acaai.org/allergytalk. And we also have the ACAAI community on Doc Matter, where we can continue the discussion about these articles. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University and the assistant editor of Allergy Watch. And today, once again, I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch, Dr. Stan Feinman.
Hi, yeah. Thanks for having me again, and it's good to be here. I'm from Atlanta, and right now I'm an adjunct faculty at Emory, and I'm a past president of the college.
And for the third chair, we're excited to be joined by Dr. Iris Otani. She's an associate professor of medicine at UCSF and assistant editor of Allergy Watch. Iris, welcome to your first podcast episode. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. As Jerry said, I'm an associate professor at UCSF in San Francisco and the medical director there for allergy immunology as well.
Okay, well, we're excited to have a few articles to talk about today. Stan, we'll start with you. I think we're learning more and more about an old friend that we used to treat, asthma. So what do you have for us?
So this is an article that was published in the journal Chest in August of 2024. It's entitled Effect of Azithromycin on Asthma Remission in Adults with Persistent Uncontrolled Asthma, a secondary analysis of a randomized, double anonymized placebo-controlled trial. And this was commented on by Dr. Josie in the Allergy Watch issue in November, December of last year. And the reason that I picked this is, besides the fact that it's in a journal Chest, which a lot of allergists don't really look at or read, and that's one of the beauties of Allergy Watch. But this is, as you said, Jerry, an old friend. And the azithromycin, everybody knows it's a macrolide. And what this article did was they did a post hoc analysis of data from the 2017 AMAZES trial. That's the asthma and macrolides, the azithromycin efficacy and safety trial, which was a 48-week randomized placebo-controlled trial. They used 3 times weekly azithromycin, 500 milligrams, and they looked at the decreasing exacerbations and improving of quality of life in uncontrolled asthma, in spite of the fact that those patients were receiving medium to high dose inhaled steroids plus controllers. And in that analysis, so that was that study that was published then, but this was the post hoc analysis. And what this analysis found was that they evaluated the ability of the individuals to achieve clinical remission at the 12 months after the treatment or the placebo, and further explored the additional definitions of remission. And I think that's one of the things that this article brings to the table, is the definition of remission, because they also include lung function stabilization and decreased sputum eosinophils as a marker of inflammation. So what the match control cohort, there were 335 participants. There were higher rates of remission were noted in patients who were treated with the azithromycin compared to placebo when evaluated by the clinical remission criteria of exacerbation and symptom control. That was 50.6% versus 38.9%. And clinical remission plus lung function criteria. So when they added the lung function as well, that's 50% versus the 37%. And those were both significant. There was also a higher proportion of patients with complete remission. That's the addition of the criteria of sputum eosinophils, but that didn't reach clinical significance, even though it was higher, like 23% versus the 13.7% in placebo. So in addition, this benefit extended to patients who were both type 2 and non-type 2 asthma. So the strength of this study is basically reporting the prevalence by varying definitions for remission, particularly sputum eosinophil criteria, and the fact that they brought in the asthma, the PFT, and also quality of life in there as well. So I think that's one of the things that this study brings to the table. And Shyam, Dr. Joshi, commented in his comments that allergists should consider its use in patients with refractory asthma as add-on therapy before or in addition to biologics. And I think that's the thing that we have to figure out is where we're going to put this in our toolbox for managing these chronic persistent asthma patients who are hard to control.
Thinking about that presentation about the preview they're working on for the new revised practice parameters, and again, this came up for Vermicin, where when we're making choices for patients who need step-up therapy at Hygiena steps, that something that is way cheaper than $5,000 a month is an option. I don't know, Iris, what's your experience with azithromycin in your severe asthma patients? I'm just curious, what do you think about using it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely something that we reach to in patients who are already maxed out on their inhaler therapy. I would be interested to know what the authors would do actually for those people who potentially have abnormal QT intervals, because that's something that comes up, I think, clinically quite a bit. And that's one of the things where we would think about maybe not prescribing it, even though it would be helpful.
Yeah, the authors point out that they are concerned that chronic azithromycin use could be associated with an increased bacterial resistance and also potential hearing impairment. And they do require the monitoring. Your point about the QT prolongation, I think it's wise to probably get an EKG if you're going to put somebody on this chronically like this.
And I think we're engaging in this shared decision-making. And I think we've sort of talked about downsides of antibiotics for a while, but actually I have an article coming up about biologics and on the flip side. So stay to the end of the episode for that. So ultimately, I think the reason I like this article is that this is not something where we are giving a little bit of antibiotic or anti-inflammatory azithromycin just to help them out. Like, these patients reach remission. I think that's pretty significant. I don't know. At least that's not what I think about. Sometimes we think that we're trying to help somebody, but we could get someone to the finish line with that. I think that that's really intriguing and actually exciting.
Yeah, the fact that they got half of patients in remission, the way they defined it, is, I think, remarkable. And even, you know, in quote, complete remission, it was almost 25%, it was 23%. But still, when this is a drug that costs pennies, I mean, compared to what some of the options are that we have.
Also, really interesting that they point out that this is the first study to achieve remission in non-eosinophilic asthma as well.
Yeah, we don't have enough weapons for that. So I think the fact that we could even offer it to T2 high or T2 low, and especially having any option for T2 low, is definitely better and better. But clearly, I think more studies will come out to investigate this, and I think the practice parameter will help us guide us in treatment selection our patients. But now I think I'm more motivated to at least lay out more options than we're definitely starting a biologic for sure, right? I think we can certainly offer choices. So Iris, I think you're the next on the schedule. I have to admit that I still to this day don't know much about polyethylene glycol hypersensitivity. So I'm actually very interested in what you have to teach us about this.
I also feel the same way, but I felt a little bit better after I read this article. So hopefully others will feel that way as well. This paper was published in the Annals of Allergy, Asthma, Immunology last year, 2024, and it's titled Polyethylene Glycol Hypersensitivity, Patient Outcomes in a 7-Year Retrospective Study. It's a 7-year study that reviews PEG allergy testing results of 44 patients from 4 different allergy centers in the UK, for whom the authors had a high suspicion for PEG allergy. I thought this paper was interesting and worth a read because it provides a thorough review of different skin testing protocols for PEG. And it also provides some pretty important evidence that people with positive PEG testing don't necessarily have to avoid all the PEG-containing products, which I think is something that patients and other providers often pose to us as a question. So first, if you actually want to look at the different PEG skin testing protocols that they provide, they put it in their supplemental table 3. They perform skin testing with different molecular weight PEGs because there's a wide range of different molecular weight PEGs, ranging from 200 all the way up to 20,000. Most of their patients were skin tested with PEG 3350, which is probably the most commonly used. It's in bowel prep. It's used to make the depot forms of medicines like methylprednisolone, medroxyprogesterone. Some patients were also skin tested with the higher molecular weight pegs of 8,000 and 20,000 as well. And the authors considered the patients to have a confirmed PEG allergy if they either had a positive skin prick test, a positive intradermal test, or a positive challenge to PEG. And so based off of that, 39 patients had either positive skin prick or intradermal testing. Only two of these patients actually underwent challenges, which were positive. The other 37 did not. And then the remaining five patients who had negative skin testing were challenged, and three had reactions, two did not. Patients were challenged with one or more of the following PEG-containing agents. So the investigators used it: depomethylprednisolone, laxido, and depomedroxyprogesterone. And now here's where things, I think, get interesting. There were patients who had positive PEG testing, but were able to tolerate other PEG-containing agents. In most cases, the tolerated PEG was the same molecular weight, or it was a little bit lower molecular weight than the index culprit agent. So to get into that a little bit more, one patient reacted when they were challenged with depomedroxyprogesterone, which has PEG 3350, but then later tolerated one macrolidal powder sachet, which is also PEG 3350. And then there were nine patients that tolerated PEG-containing medications, Octasa, which is mesalazine with PEG 6,000, regavidone, which is an estrogen progesterone contraceptive with PEG 6,000, and then a sitagliptin formulation with PEG 3350. And then seven patients, they tolerated either Allegra or fexofenadine with PEG 400, 4,000 in the film coat, or cetirizine with PEG 4,000 in the film coat. So I thought that was particularly interesting because I have seen patients who come in and they have either a label or a confirmed PEG allergy, and there's concern about how are they going to treat things like hives. But this seems like it's worth doing a challenge and having them try the fexofenadine or cetirizine. COVID vaccines is another question that comes up a lot. And in this study, there were also five patients that received and tolerated PEG-containing COVID vaccines. So I think that is in line with other studies that showed that even if you may have some positive PEG skin testing, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to avoid all of the PEG-containing COVID vaccines. It may be still worth having people get them in the clinic or in a monitored setting. So yeah, I think one of the really main takeaway points from this article is that, yes, there are people who react to PEG-containing agents. That was clearly shown in the study, like there were positive PEG challenges. But it doesn't necessarily mean they have to avoid everything in the future. There's, I think, some misconception around PEG allergy that it's associated with reacting to everything because it's really ubiquitous in a lot of different pharmaceuticals. But even with patients with positive PEG skin testing, they can tolerate other PEG-containing drugs. So that's one of the important roles that we can have as allergists to help balance the risk of additional challenges with the benefit of allowing patients to get the medicines they need for treatment.
Iris, I have a question. Did the authors talk about the types of reactions that the index patients had to the PEG initially?
That's a great question because I had the same question. They do categorize the reactions by the ground rating criteria. They didn't go too much into detail about exactly what symptoms were. So it's basically the investigators included people who they thought had a high pretest probability for having a true PEG allergy based on their history. Didn't go too much more into detail other than saying these are the Brown grading criteria that they fall into.
Now, we did a lot of PEG testing when COVID vaccines first came out, but you know, we really haven't done any significantly since that time. That was the big scare. And interestingly, I did worry about some false positive reactions when we were doing some of the intradermal testing, and the patients did, you know, were able to tolerate PEG products, including the vaccines, even though they might have had a small positive on the intradermal. Was that your experience too? I mean,
yeah, that was definitely my experience. You know, certainly the authors in this study, if you look at what they skin tested to, they did skin test with a wide range of different PEGs for some of their patients. The skin testing that we did for the COVID vaccine evaluations did come up with a lot of false positive skin testings. And so really thinking about when to go directly to challenges as well, I think is important.
I just feel terrible in the sense that I'm not sure I've seen a lot of these patients. So I just need to feel like some validation I'm not alone. So could you tell me how many actual confirmed PEC patients y'all see? I'm not talking about positive skin tests. I'm talking about like how many patients are there with reactions to bowel prep or pegylated products? Because I always feel like a bad allergist when I don't see these patients, like I didn't think of it. So what's your been experience in seeing these patients?
My personal experience is I have not seen a confirmed PEG allergy patient either. There are patients who had hives after getting their COVID vaccine, for sure, that I've seen. But many of them were able to receive their booster without a problem. And then also patients who've had reactions to bowel prep and came in for testing. Ultimately, all of the ones that I've seen, at least, have been able to successfully get bowel prep in the future.
Yeah, that's my experience, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, mine as well. I mean, in terms of, you know, this was really not on our radar screen. We didn't see patients with clinically significant reactions to PEG before this COVID. And then we obviously started testing a lot. But the diagnosis of a drug reaction in some situations is very difficult because they're taking so many other things sometimes. And anyway, I think it's good to collect this kind of data. It's good to know about it. I'm glad that you talked about an article from the Annals that brings this to our attention and helps us to evaluate these in the future.
I think my take home is I certainly will be thinking of PEG when people talk about reactions, but it clearly seems to me that we have a lot of options. Number one, COVID vaccine is absolutely still on the table. And also, we could substitute a product or rechallenge with something else, and they might do fine, and they have choices. So this is really good to bring to our attention. Thank you, Iris, for viewing that. Okay. So I would like to end out this with an article that was published in JCI from Emory. Dr. Eunyoung Lee is the section chief on the internal medicine asthma allergy section, and she does a lot of B-cell immunology. And I just thought this was a very intriguing article. So the title is Patients Taking Benralizumab, Dupilumab, or Mepolizumab Have Lower Post-Vaccination SARS-CoV-2 Immunity. First author is Dr. Runstrom. Okay, so when we think about T2 biologics, we don't really think about the consequences to antibody production. You know, we have heard about these increased cutaneous viral infections. There was a concern for live viral vaccines for dupilumab. And I know a lot of people have discussed this in Delphi consensus and so on. But we have to recognize, though, that Th2 cytokines, IL-4, 5, and 13, do participate in B-cell immunology. This is back in good old Abbas and basic immunology. We know that IL-4, class switching to IgE, is important for B-cell development and maintenance. Follicular helper T-cells, they secrete IL-4. That participates in affinity maturation. And interleukin-5, there is some data on interleukin-5's involvement in the differentiation of survival plasma cells. And anti-IL-5 potentially could affect the maintenance of long-lived plasma cells. And there are mucosal antibody-secreting cells or long-lived plasma cells that have IL-5 receptor alpha. So if you deplete IL-5 receptor alpha expressing cells with benralizumab, could you be affecting those antibody-secreting cells? So it's sort of the background of this that we're trying to investigate, what is the effect of T2 biologics on antibody production? Now, the background of this is that there are papers out there that have already looked at this, and post-vaccination responses in the short term, 4 weeks after vaccination, on T2 biologics don't seem to have an effect. But Dr. Lee is taking like a long-term time point at 6 months after vaccination because we're interested in, like, again, long-term antibody production. So she was able to get 57 patients on biologics. 80% of them had asthma, 33% had atopic dermatitis. And they had this control group of 46 patients not on biologics. 20% of those had asthma, none on AD. And again, they were not on biologics. And we are looking at the antibody response to a two-dose series of an mRNA COVID vaccine, either Pfizer or Moderna, and looking at their six-month post-vaccination response, antibody responses, as well as other markers of affinity. I'll tell you that later. And these patients were on either benralizumab, mepolizumab, or dupilumab. And so the first thing they looked at was they did this multiplex bead based immunofluorescence assay, right, to look for SARS-CoV-2 antibodies. And 6 months after the second dose, there was a statistically significant decrease in patients on biologics versus the controls. Now, they took one step further, where they looked at neutralization assays using either a pseudovirus they created. So you just take SARS-CoV plasmids and stick it into a lentiviral vector, and then you incubate that with the patient's serum. And then they have this cell line that overexpresses ACE2. You know, ACE2 is what the virus used to enter the cell. So we're seeing how well can this antibodies from the patient's serum block viral entry on an ACE2 cell line. So they did that not only with pseudoviruses, but they also did it with COVID virus. And there actually was a decreased ability for the patients on biologics to block viral entry with these antibodies. Another thing that they looked at is they looked at SARS-CoV-2 specific B cells and spike reactive CD8 cells. And again, there were significant decreases in those cells in the patients on biologics. And so if you want to really take a step back here, I think overall, the yin and the yang is we're showing that there's potentially a decreased ability to mount a B cell directed response at an mRNA vaccine on a T2 biologic, both IL-4/13, dupilumab, and IL-5 specific biologics. Now, interestingly, we're not seeing worsening infections from COVID despite all this, but that sort of makes sense in the arena that the susceptibility to severe COVID is actually a hyperinflammatory response, right? It's actually the patients who got super sick was due to an overactive immune response. So I'm not suggesting here that the consequences of this would affect the severity of COVID infections, but I think this makes me wonder about the broader effects of T2 biologics on other antibody responses to other infections. And again, that's not what they're studying here. And clearly, we're going to say that these are small numbers. So I think there is a letter to the editor that suggests that further studies are needed in a larger cohort that came out in the July issue of JACI. But I don't know. I think we really need to learn more about the side effects of these T2 biologics that may be missed because ultimately, we're not looking specifically at this question. And again, there's a lot of benefit from these biologics. Obviously, infections are going to be less severe if you have something controlling underlying asthma. So then the signal to noise may be obscured when we're trying to measure infections in the context where we're giving something that helps a patient manage infection versus their susceptibility to it. Anyways, I thought that was a very provocative article, and I don't know what y'all think about that.
So, Jerry, when I saw this article, I thought about the fact that we give high-dose flu vaccine to the elderly and people who are infirm to make sure they have an adequate response. I wonder if you'd have a reduced reaction or immunization to the flu vaccine as well, and whether or not we should consider higher-dose vaccines for some of these patients on biologics.
I just think maybe we need to extend this to other vaccines, get larger populations. But I do think there is a signal here, and it does make sense from what we know from basic immunology. The severity of it and the consequences for patients, I think, is what's not clear.
Yeah, this is really interesting because I think a common question that patients ask when we talk to them about these biologic therapies is this one of those biologics or one of those medications that's really going to suppress my immune system? And I think based off of what we've known so far, I say this is very specific. It's targeting IL-4. It's targeting the Th2 pathway. It's not like some of those other biologics, but this study seems to suggest that there's something else that we should be looking at.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, Iris. I'm not sure if I'm ready to incorporate this into my shared decision-making, like don't take it because you won't respond to a vaccine. I don't think we're ready to say that. But at the same time, yeah, I don't think we should brush it off either. I think if a patient wants to know there's a potential increased infection risk, where we know about the potential viral infection risk and whether that's related to this or not or so on, I think we should be upfront that there is sort of potential increased risk of infection, which I think we generally say for anything that affects the immune system, but certainly just targeting the T2 pathway does mean this could extend beyond just worm infections or parasites or something like that.
And in this study, the control group, they also had asthma and atopic dermatitis. They were just not treated with biologics.
No, sorry, I apologize. So 20% had asthma, and then none of them had atopic dermatitis. So yes, you'd wonder, they had more asthma patients, or you had an asthma control, not on biologics, would be different. They did mention that the inhaled steroids use didn't seem to make a difference, but then you wonder about that. So I think there's enough there that further studies need to occur. So those are our articles for today. If you liked what you heard, please rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts. I am always looking for feedback from the audience. If you have any thoughts about the articles we talked about today, if you have any corrections or suggestions, our email is allergytalk@acaai.org. Don't forget about CME credit. That website is education.acaai.org/allergytalk. And we continue to release issues of Allergy Watch. If you missed an issue and you want to look at our archive, that is college.acaai.org/publications/Allergy Watch. Anyways, that's it. My name is Jerry Lee. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Enjoy the rest of your day. ACAAI is presenting this podcast for educational purposes only. It is not medical advice or intended to replace the judgment of a licensed physician. The college is not responsible for any claims related to the procedures, professionals, products, or methods discussed in the podcast, and it does not approve or endorse any products, professionals, services, or methods that might be referenced.